Very good. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is February 29, 2024. I'll have the Marshall call court to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Werke, Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
These matters are being conducted by Zoom this morning. We have one case on our Zoom calendar, A220234. Lang versus State of Minnesota. Thank you, counsel, for the accommodation in moving this matter to Zoom. I hope everyone's doing well this morning. You are both familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. Please state your name and identify yourself before you begin speaking. These matters are being recorded. And with that, counsel, anytime you are ready, you may begin. Counsel, you're muted.
Can you hear me now?
I can. Go ahead.
My name is Charles Hawkins. I represent the appellant, James Lockhart Lang, in these matters. Mr. Lang presents three issues for the court's consideration today. The first issue is whether or not the testimony of the alleged accomplice is sufficiently corroborated by other evidence to sustain his conviction. Second is whether or not the district court erred in denying Mr. Lang's post-conviction relief petition based upon his conviction being predicated upon false evidence. Third, Mr. Lang is entitled to a new trial based upon newly discovered evidence. Before I get to the crux of those three issues, I'd like to address briefly some chronological time frames that are relevant here, in my opinion. The assault that's the foundation of the charges here occurred on January 26th, 2017. On May 26th, 5 months later, 4 months later, there's a check that's written to the assailant, Mr. Buckner, by Fabrication Station in the amount of $387. There's another $100 check written on June 9th, 2017, a $175 check written on June 16th, 2017, a $144.50 check written on July 14th, 2017, a $70 check issued on 10-6-17, October 6th, and a $100 check written on March 9th, 2018. This is the documentary evidence that we'll talk about when we're talking about corroboration, but I think it's important to put in perspective that the first connection with Mr. Buckner isn't until May 26th.
Wasn't it, Mr. Hawkins? Wasn't it, Mr. Hawkins, the fact that the district court found that your client's testimony was not consistent with what the evidence was as far as the sufficiency of this matter? I mean, first of all, an investigator showed Lang a picture of Buckner, and Lang said didn't know who he was and disputed all of this evidence until another employee came forward. So how do you get around the inconsistencies in his testimony?
Well, number one, it wasn't testimony. It was some officer that didn't identify himself as a police officer that showed up in a showroom where there are people around. And that interview took place on August 14th, 2019. That's 22 months after the July check, and it's 14 months after the March 29th check, and it's a year and 2 months later, and you have an individual where the checks consistently demonstrate, and there's two areas here. There's the showroom and the warehouse, and what you have here is information that's consistent with day labor, but it shows up after all of the allegations regarding the assault. And this August 14th, 2019 Merwin visit, which lasts for a very short period of time, says, no, I don't know the guy. One of the guys there says he worked for us. He did unloading. Jim Lang says, yeah, okay, he worked for us as unloader. And the checks demonstrate that after this happened, Sims, who was a friend of his, who gets him a job 4 months after the assault, it does not support or corroborate to any substantial way that back in January, Mr. Lang went out and hired Buckner to commit an assault.
What about the, Mr. Hawkins, sorry to interrupt. What about the evidence of the relationship between Lang and the victim in the case? Is that, you know, that they had a history of litigation and that it was sometimes bitter? Is that corroborating Buckner's testimony?
It's not corroborating a Buckner's testimony for a number of reasons. Number one is that Kallenbeck says there are a number of individuals I've been involved in litigation with that are capable of doing this to me. Do they find out who those other individuals are? Not in my opinion, but he does identify that there are multiple individuals that are capable of doing this when he's initially interviewed by Merwin. Second thing is, when it comes down to, if you accept the fact, for argument's sake, that you're going to send a message to somebody and you want them to understand that something's going to happen, you deliver a message. There was no message delivered. There is no connection from the beating to Mr. Lang to say, the reason this is happening to you is because of the animosity that has developed between us. He's trying to get paid out of a trust account that he's been ordered to distribute and won't do it. But nobody says, pay the debts you're responsible for. Buckner never delivers any message whatsoever. He hit the guy. That is not the substantial corroboration that they're talking about when they say you have to have this information corroborated. The bottom line is, when you look at the state's position on corroboration, they talk about Buckner knew appellant. Yeah. Somewhere along the line between May of 2017, 4 months after the assault, and October of 2018, over these six working periods that are small. I mean, you're getting $100, $100 for your labor. And they claim that this is a connection that Buckner knew appellant, where appellant's going to go to Buckner, but they don't point out that there is no evidence that he ever met him on or about or before January 26th of 2017. Let's assume, for argument's sake, that, you know, you look at page 24 of the state's reply brief for their corroboration. There's no corroboration for Buckner's statement, I got paid $500, $100 cash, and a $400 check. They searched the bank accounts. They didn't have a check written to Buckner until the defendant disclosed that after the fact, by 4 months, there was a relationship of employment. But there is no indication that he got a $400 check, which he says he collected on February 14th. There's no corroboration for the statement that this documented connection, without the time frame that we talked about, doesn't sufficiently corroborate. But one of the things that I find interesting is if you accept for argument's sake, and I'm not getting there, but just for right now, that Lang hired Buckner to assault Kallenbeck. If I get charged, if I get hired to go assault somebody, and I'm getting paid $500, and then I get charged with the offense of third-degree assault because I did this for you, I'm not going to have a public defender representing me. I'm going to Mr. Lang and saying, look, you got me into this. I want you to get me a lawyer. There's nothing to indicate other than these few checks, which are labor checks, that there's any connection between these individuals. This claim that the dollar store burner phone was Mr. Lang, that he Googled, these are all things that you need corroboration for. There isn't any. There is no evidence to show there was a Google search.
Well,
there is
they,
no.
Are they all things that you need corroboration for? I mean, does the requirement for corroboration of accomplice testimony apply to every aspect of what an accomplice says, or does it just generally have to support the allegation against the accused? What is the?
Well, I don't think it can be general. I think there has to be some sort of substantial, which I suggest to you is specific corroboration. When somebody comes and says,
what's your best case that supports that proposition, that the scope of the corroboration has to be as specific as you're identifying?
I guess I'd say State versus Turnage, which is found, the citation is 729 Northwest 2nd 503, Minnesota Supreme Court 2007. And I say that because they say it has to point to the defendant's guilt in a substantial way. And to have these tangential type things, even when taken together as a whole, when you look at page 23 or 24, basically, of the corroboration they point to in the general, nonspecific, I suggest unsubstantial means to point directly to James Lang's guilt. I'd like to just briefly go to false testimony. And the first prong of the false testimony is that court reasonably well satisfied testimony given by a material witness is false. Number one, there's no question that Buckner's the material witness in the case. The whole case.
And that's a problem we have as a reviewing court. I mean, the district court found the prong was not met, and that the information was not reputable. So what, we can't substitute our decision on that. What do we do about that?
Well, I suggest to the court that the district court erred in not finding that we presented a preponderance of the evidence to demonstrate this. Our burden is a preponderance of the evidence. When you go to, for instance, Osval, which we cite in our reply brief at page 15, Judge Meyer, I believe, wrote for the Supreme Court at page 424, the petition and affidavits challenge the truth or believability of 5 out of 7 witnesses who testified that they heard Asphalt make incriminating statements. We conclude that the post-conviction court abused its discretion by concluding that the jury would, this is the second element, have reached the same result without recanted testimony. This is an appeal regarding whether they should have been given an evidentiary hearing. But they come to the conclusion, which a district court can do, and I can suggest to you that
you got the precious thing. You got the evidentiary hearing.
We got the evidentiary hearing.
The problem was that the district court had no way of assessing the credibility of the evidence that was put in because you didn't have an evidentiary hearing.
We didn't have a hearing, but the district court can make its decision without an evidentiary hearing on the face of the documents and the sworn testimony and the depositions. That is acceptable under a petition for post-conviction relief. And whether or not we would have been satisfied the burden if the state had cross-examined witnesses or didn't want to stipulate, that's a different ballgame. But this evidence came in uncontradicted when you look at these depositions. Kallenbeck didn't ask any questions. The state didn't ask any questions. Nobody asked any questions. It was accepted as being true.
Mr. Hawkins?
Yes, ma'am.
Your time has expired. You will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. All right?
Thank you much.
Thank you, sir. Counsel, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent respondent State of Minnesota in this matter. And I do want to thank the court and counsel for making this accommodation today. So following a stipulated facts trial in this case, the district court found appellant guilty of aiding and abetting the third degree assault. It is undisputed that the victim was assaulted and suffered substantial bodily harm. The question at trial and what's now being raised on appeal is whether the evidence was sufficient and accurate in proving that appellant aided and abetted that assault by hiring the assailant to commit that assault. So appellant argues that some of the stipulated facts pertaining to some of Buckner's statements to law enforcement were false. However, under the case law and applying the Larison standard, appellant failed to meet his burden to prove false testimony. Case law is clear that inconsistent statements of a witness does not establish false testimony. And so as I'm happy to answer questions on that issue, I believe, you know, also I want to point out that the court has a well-reasoned and thorough order from the district court who reviewed this issue. And that is, you know, afforded deference by this court. I'm happy to answer any questions you have, but I believe it's, you know, fully briefed and with the benefit of the district court's reasoning as well. The appellant also argued newly discovered evidence. And so under the Rayner test, that alternatively, he was entitled to relief there, both on Buckner's statements as well as a sworn statement by the individual Sims. However, as laid out in the briefing, the appellant again failed to meet his burden under the four prongs of the Rayner test to establish that he is entitled to a new trial there. And then lastly, he raises insufficiency of the evidence. To the contrary, there is ample evidence in this case, both direct and corroborating, to convict appellant of aiding and abetting the third degree assault in this case. Again, because appellant chose to have a stipulated facts trial, this court also on the sufficiency of the evidence claim has the benefit of a written order from the district court with findings of fact and conclusions of law. And that has afforded great deference by this court. You know, I think this case is unusual in the fact that, you know, the appellant could have had a full jury trial with live testimony, cross-examination, test the credibility of the witnesses. He chose not to do that. He chose to have a stipulated facts trial. And again, with the post-conviction proceeding, the post-conviction court granted him the opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing, to call live witnesses, for the court to be able to assess the credibility of Buckner's statements. He again chose not to do that and rested on the papers. In this way, he just has failed to meet the burden to be entitled to a new trial or relief in this case. I think going to some of the discussion that appellant had with the panel on corroboration, I would point to the case I cited in my brief, State v. Herr, which says that corroboration is sufficient if it restores confidence in the accomplice's testimony and confirms its truth and points to the guilt of the appellant. And I believe the corroboration in this case does just that, and it is sufficient. The fact that the appellant is the only link between all of the actors that have been mentioned in this case, appellant is the only link to the victim. He's the only link to Buckner. He's the only link to Sims. Just none of this, there is no reasonable alternative theory or hypothesis without appellant's involvement in this case. So I'm just trying to think if there's any other specific points I want to make based on opposing counsel's comments earlier. I guess I would also just point to, for the sufficiency of the evidence argument, I would point the court to the second interview that Buckner had with law enforcement, which was in August of 2021. That was both part of the stipulated facts as Exhibit 23, and we also offered it again in the post-conviction proceedings on the separate claims. But that second interview, Buckner does make some inconsistent statements. He says that he doesn't remember some things clearly. He seems to start to implicate Sims' involvement in this, in how this played out. And so the district court heard all of that. The district court, took both of all of Buckner's statements and all of the evidence, and viewing it, made credibility determinations, found Buckner credible, found appellant not credible. And so that is afforded a lot of deference now when reviewing this case. I think unless the panel has any other questions, I believe that this case has been thoroughly briefed. The court has both written orders from the district court on all the issues. And we would ask this court to affirm those orders of the district court and affirm appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Is there anything from the panel? All right, seeing none, thank you very much. Mr. Hawkins, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you choose to use it, just wait one moment. There it is. Anytime you're ready, sir.
Thank you. When we look at the district court's post-conviction order, we look at testimony in the depositions early on. But as you start to go on and you get away from pages 20 to 41, and you start to get into pages 60 to 120, everything changes. Everything that was accurate and truthful regarding this investigation and Buckner's statements become unreliable and become recanted by the statements that are made as the deposition moves on. There is no reasonable hypothesis except this of guilt of Mr. Lang. And the answer to that is yes, there is. Sims, Buckner's lifelong friend from Chicago, who he says got him into doing this, that Lang eventually, under the evidence adduced through the depositions, which Callum Beck brought, we find that Sims is the guy that asked him to do it, and there is nothing between Sims and Lang. There is a reasonable hypothesis that Sims got his buddy Buckner to do this without any knowledge by Lang. Interestingly, Judge Scoggins says, quote, "The contents of the depositions created doubt in the court about what happened in this case." I'd suggest by a preponderance of the evidence, we have shown that the court was reasonably well satisfied that a material witness testified falsely, and that without the testimony, the jury might have reached the fact finder, the judge, might have reached a different conclusion. We don't need to get to the third element of this because it's not absolute and necessary. But the bottom line is, but for Kallenbeck filing this civil lawsuit against Lang and Buckner, where Buckner had every reason in the world to put the jacket on Lang to insulate himself, or at least try and put down the responsibility that he'd have by implicating Lang, he does just the opposite and takes Lang completely out of it and puts the whole thing on him and Sims. Now, that is something that we didn't have access to until this lawsuit was filed. We didn't have access to Buckner during the course of any investigation based upon our ethics rules. And the reality of the situation is the court has to really consider strongly. Think about this. He enters a cooperation agreement to get a gross misdemeanor. He's got an incentive in this matter, and it's not to testify truthfully. It's to assist in the prosecution of Lang. And when he won't identify Sims, and he won't identify the driver, you're asking for full cooperation from somebody against Lang, but you won't investigate the case when an individual cooperating under a real, real good plea agreement, and you have to be concerned about the motivation. You don't ask him to tell you who it is, or we're not going to continue to use you as a cooperator, that you allow, or you're going to be the person that tells us what you're going to tell us and what you're not going to tell us. And what you have to remember about this is he had this discovery before he ever went in and was debriefed on the day or the day before trial. That's when this all started. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted. Thank you for your argument this morning. We will receive an opinion within the statutory time period. And that concludes our calendar today. And so we are adjourned. Thank you. Have a nice day, everyone.
Anna, be well.